Thanks for listening to the Best of Herd Podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday from 12 to 3 Eastern, 9 to noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and FS1. Find your local station for the Herd at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching Herd.
This is the Best of the Herd with Colin Cowherd on Fox Sports Radio.
What up? Welcome in. This is the Herd, wherever you may be and however you may be listening to the show. Thanks so much for making this part of your day. Live from Los Angeles, I'm Doug Gottlieb, filling in for Colin Cowherd alongside the lovely and talented and always prepared Joy Taylor. We are hours away, essentially, from college football kicking off. We are finally putting to bed preseason football. I know there's another game. There's some more games this weekend. Feels like the NFL and, frankly, one CFL field made a mockery of preseason football.
Well, you know, every once in a while we need a legendary sports story to kind of trigger a conversation of change, right?
Right. Remember that time the Packers played the Raiders in Winnipeg on an 80-yard field? You're like, what? That really happened?
What a hoot.
Huh?
What a hoot. That was something else.
That is something like in this, you learn something new every day. I knew the goalposts were in the middle or the front of the end zone of the CFL. I just would have thought it would have been discussed, like, you know, sometime before the game to figure that thing out.
You would think, yes.
That is absolutely, absolutely bizarre. All right, more on that. Plus, this is a special treat. Obviously, Fox College Football kickoff starts this Saturday, starts tomorrow. Fox Noon kickoff starts tomorrow. And we're going to have Urban Meyer, Reggie Bush, Matt Leinart, Brady Quinn, and Rob Stone all joining us upcoming in 15 minutes. I got to ask Urban Meyer about the most recent comments from Jim Harbaugh in a new book about Michigan football, which he said the SEC is a bunch of cheaters. And, of course, Urban Meyer won 2 national championships while coaching in the SEC. We'll get to that upcoming in 15 minutes. James Harrison's going to join us. Jeff Schwartz is going to join us. We will talk about some of the Daniel Jones thing with the New York Giants. We got a lot to get to. Let's start, though, with the Dallas Cowboys, shall we, as the contract negotiations continue in the media. Yesterday, Ed Werder, who, of course, has covered the Cowboys for years, tweeted this out. Sources, the most recent offer negotiations between holdout Ezekiel Elliott and the Cowboys came from the team. Elliott has been offered a contract making him one of the NFL's 2 highest paid running backs. That would suggest the team offering more than Le'Veon Bell and less than Todd Gurley. Now, obviously, this comes from the team, right? Ed has covered the Cowboys for a long, long time, and the team putting out the details, and the devil is in the details in terms of what is the real money. But I listened to the commentary, and I'm struck by this, Joy. I think at some point Jerry Jones has been pushed to the limit, and he's at the point now where he feels like Ezekiel Elliott is ungrateful. And I'll explain why in a moment. Here was Jerry Jones. Remember there was that subtle joke last Saturday? They got a rookie running back, Tony Pollard. He had 5 carries, 42 yards, playing against really the 3rd stringers from the LA Rams. Had a really good day. And so, you know, the reporters were joking, you know, hey, what a great negotiating tool you have with Zeke. Now you got this Tony Pollard kid. And so Jerry Jones, you know, joked, Zeke who? And then he circled back to talking about how great Zeke was. And so after it came out, Zeke's camp, again, through the media and his agent, said that not only was his agent, but also Ezekiel Elliott felt disrespected, felt dissed, right, by Jerry Jones for saying that. Take a listen to Jerry Jones earlier this week justifying his subtle jab at Zeke.
Look, I've earned the right with Zeke to joke. Period.
Right.
I've earned it.
So have you guys had any conversations since then at all?
No. Okay. Well, let me be real clear about it. I've earned that right to joke.
Let me be real clear about that. I have earned that right. Now, could he be discussing the fact that they're willing to give Ezekiel Elliott a contract extension, even though he has no-showed, even though he's played this out through the media, even though he's under contract for two more years and potentially two more after that, actually as a franchise taggy. Like, they're negotiating against themselves if they change the details of this deal. Sure. But I think what's really at play here is, one, Jerry Jones has always had the back of his players, even when his players have been led astray off the football field. Michael Irvin, Pac-Man Jones. I mean, you just kind of go through, I mean, even the disasters of the Greg Hardy signing, right? He has believed in players. Is it for the benefit of his franchise? Sure. There's a little, you know, selfishly, I think he obviously benefits from standing by guys that are super talented that can't always get their life in order. But I think that Jerry is seen as a guy who takes care of Quincy Carter, former Cowboy quarterback, right? How much did he stand by him? You go back, since Jerry Jones has taken over this franchise, a historic name, but it was a dilapidated franchise, the money he's invested, the time he's invested, and the emotional energy he's invested. And then you look at Ezekiel Elliott. Like, let's not forget, Jerry Jones organized a coup d'etat on Roger Goodell, the commissioner of the National Football League. Now, the coup was struck down. But he went right at the head of Jerry Jones, tried to have him removed. And it wasn't just to defend Ezekiel Elliott. Look, we're in 2019. The last 3 or 4 years, America has finally gotten a backbone against domestic violence. We've finally stood up and said, hey, let's support the women. Let's punish the men. And even during that time, however frivolous some may have believed the claims against Ezekiel Elliott were, this was over a 6-game suspension that Jerry Jones went to the mattresses. Went to the mattresses, Godfather. Here I go to the mattresses, right? Went to the mattresses to try and get Roger Goodell removed. Now, it didn't work, and Goodell got a contract extension, and the Cowboys season went down the tubes because they didn't have Zeke. But on the football field, he's built a team around the talents of Zeke. He spent a ton of money on that offensive line. He's tried to get all the right pieces in place to get the best out of Ezekiel Elliott. They've built a tremendous defense. They've done a great job in player acquisition, player development. That's a young, athletic defense. Case in point, the chance they took on Jalen Smith and how it's been rewarded, and then they rewarded Jalen Smith. And you get to the point where you look, I've done a lot of stuff for this kid. Right? I drafted him high. I believed in him. We built the offense around him. I made sure the offensive coordinators knew he needed to have the ball. When he stepped astray outside the football field, I protected him. I battled for him. I've always been there for him. Not only is he asking for top dollar, which will take money from the pie. Remember, he also said there's less pie to go around now when they signed Jalen Smith. Not only would, but every other guy who's under contract for 2 years is going to come into my door asking for a new contract. And here's a guy whose back I had on and off the football field. And he has there's a Yiddish term, chutzpah. It means nerve or a lower intestinal fortitude. He has the chutzpah through his agent to say he felt disrespected because I joked Zeke who, even though he has a standing offer to be the second highest paid running back in the history of the National Football League. I think Jerry Jones feels like Ezekiel Elliott is ungrateful. Right? Feels like he's ungrateful. And sure, there's a little bit of unhealthy, I'm the father, you're the son kind of relationship between Jerry and players. I'm okay if you point that out. But as a father with a son and with daughters, I can tell you all you can ever ask of your kids is to be grateful. Right? Because the greatest thing you can give to anyone in the world is an opportunity. Right? That's I talk about this when I go and do public speaking, Joy. I do this whole thing about how I made it when I was at the other place, because when there were snowstorms, when there were nor'easters, I would go knock on the doors of producers like, hey, you know, Jay Billis can't get in here tonight. I can do SportsCenter. All I wanted was an opportunity. You don't have to pay me. I'll just do it. Stick me on. Give me a mic. Red light. I go. Tell me when to rap, and I'm good. I filled in for Colin there, filled in for Colin in Sports Station. Just give me opportunities. It's the greatest thing. We think and pray for all these other things. But if you get an opportunity and prepare yourself for it, and you kick butt, you're going to get more opportunities. Jerry Jones is sitting there going like, hey, man, I gave you all these opportunities. I protected you. I battled for you. When you messed up, I was there for you. I support you in the face of the strongest headwind. Right? The movement against domestic violators has been probably the strongest headwind we've ever seen against current professional athletes. And by the way, rightfully so. He stood up and stood by the guy. And now you're going to get mad because he told a little joke that was funny and everyone knew it was sarcastic. No one thought it was really in the heart offensive. While you have a standing offer to be the second highest paid player at your position in the history of the sport, stop it. Stop it. Now you're acting spoiled, ungrateful. And now I'm at my limit. Now, look, Ezekiel Elliott does have some support from some current and former players. Here's Marcellus Wiley on Speak for Yourself, going back to yesterday.
It's impossible if I'm Ezekiel Elliott to sign this deal. One, immediately I see this deal as less than. Less than someone who already got paid. And guess what's going to happen as soon as I sign on the dotted line? I'm going to get leapfrogged, and we'll be right back in this situation. So now I'm going to be sitting there at top five before I blink, and then we'll be right back here, Jerry. Your ego needs the headline of, I did this. I'm the highest paid running back, even if it's for 5 seconds, just because I am the best running back. I need that to be sold to me.
Yeah, the problem is that's not the reality of the market. The running back market's going through a market correction. Todd Gurley signed that deal a year ago. Le'Veon Bell signed one this year. It's for less money. And the reality is Todd Gurley's deal is a bad deal, and Le'Veon Bell's deal is so bad, the GM who signed it got fired shortly thereafterwards. Like, I understand. Like, there's not going to be bigger paydays. Saquon Barkley might be the best back in the league, but he's not going to get more money. That's not the reality of the position, the reality of the sport, unless they change the rules. So I get the old school, I need to be the highest paid, but the reality of the sport, the correction of the market, and, oh, yeah, by the way, you're under contract for 2 more years. I guarantee had he played at his current contract for a year or at least showed up in camp, he would have had a stronger case. But he needs to get paid, but not as much as Dak, not as much as Amari Cooper, Byron Jones, and there will be others. And if you want to truly win games, sometimes you got to take a little bit less.
Be sure to catch live editions of The Herd weekdays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio, FS1, and the iHeartRadio app.
Fox Noon Kickoff. And of course, one of our new analysts, Fox Noon Kickoff, is the legendary coach at Ohio State, won national championship there, won national championships at Florida. Urban Meyer joins us in The Herd. Coach, how are you?
I'm good. Great to see you.
Okay, let's start with your best friend from that school from the north, who there's a new book out, and in the new book, he says it's hard to beat cheaters, right? He's talking about the SEC. The head coach of Michigan, Jim Harbaugh, says it's hard to beat cheaters. When you heard that, when you read that, what was your immediate reaction?
My immediate reaction is the season starting in 1 week and the focus has got to be on your team. I'm not sure, you know, I probably shook my head like most people. Like, why is that being this? Why have a conversation about this now? And all focus needs to be on your team. And I imagine it created interest, like we're talking about it now, but that's not important. You got to go get ready to go play a game.
Okay, and in fairness, it is in a book, and I know I don't know how much he can control over when John Bacon's book comes out. But you have coached at both places. You've won both places. You've won in the Big Ten. You've won in the SEC. How different is the recruiting? Like, is the perception is that the SEC cheats. That's the perception. What's the reality?
Tough question. I hear the same stories. I was there for 6 years. I heard many, many stories over and over again. Obviously, you know, if it was true, then there'd be guys getting in trouble all the time. So I hear it. Here's what I'm going to tell you is that the South is so intense recruiting. Anytime you put the majority, not the majority, but just a huge quantity of elite players in a certain area, and right now, because of the population shift, because of a lot of the quality of spring football, it is so intense. It's completely different than the Big Ten recruiting. And at least when I first got to the Big Ten didn't recruit like the SEC. I think you see more and more of it now, and I'm not talking about cheating. I'm talking about intensity, 24/7, nonstop recruiting. And that's what you see in the SEC.
Do you think it would be fair to say you take more chances in terms of I don't know necessarily character issues, but backgrounds is like, look, it is a kind of win or else league, and maybe you take more chances than you would at some other places. Is that a fair characterization?
I think so. Once I was there, you would take chances when I was there. And what would happen is you'd look and evaluate this player and say, no, wait a minute, if we don't recruit this guy, we're going to have to play against him. And I don't want to see this guy on the opposite sideline. So do you have a tendency to take more chances maybe on a lower character guy than elite player? I can say that I did.
We're going to see Florida, school. You won two national championships there. You had that incredible run where you won 24 consecutive games. And as you told me, after losing in the Sugar Bowl, people questioned you about the direction of the program, right? By the intensity of the SEC. But remind me, like, you were at Notre Dame. I was at Notre Dame for a year. You came in the next year. And when you were at Bowling Green and then at Utah, the perception nationally was Notre Dame was your dream job. Like, I know you went to Cincinnati and played there and you got your MBA from Ohio State, but Notre Dame seemed to be your dream job. And when you took the Florida job, you actually either interviewed or talked with Notre Dame before you took the Florida job. Why turn down such a prestigious job to take the Florida job?
It was, we just finished undefeated season at Utah, and Florida came to see us. Jan Ray Foley came to see us right after our last game against Brigham Young. And, you know, my wife had always wanted to live in the South. Florida, I kind of watched from afar. I was always a huge fan of Steve Spurrier, but I'm Irish Catholic. I grew up a Notre Dame fan. I spent 6 years there. My son was baptized at Notre Dame. We loved it there. And I just, you know, the bottom line in the coaching profession is you don't have time to build programs anymore. You better get it going right now. Ron Zook was a previous head coach of Florida. I evaluated the rosters the best I could, and I felt Florida had the better roster. You know, Ron Zook, like I said, tremendous recruiter. They had Chris Lee coming back. They had Chad Jackson, Bubba Caldwell. I did my homework, and I thought, you know what, you get one swing, and I think the best chance to win is going to be at the University of Florida.
I think it was probably the right choice in anyone's hindsight. You mentioned the great year you had at Utah. Of course, you beat Alabama in the Sugar Bowl that year, right?
No, we beat Pitt in the Fiesta Bowl.
Sorry,
that was a couple years later.
Okay, a couple years later. But you finished undefeated. Alex Smith was your quarterback. You had a great second. You turned it at Bowling Green. The two national championships at Florida. The unbelievable run. Maybe the first year at Ohio State was as impressive as the national championship at Ohio State when you turned it late in the season. Is there one year which, when you look back, was more enjoyable? Like, it was actually more fun to be undefeated at Utah than it was to win national championships at Florida. Or was the Florida, was there one that was more enjoyable than the others?
You know, I was just back at Utah, and I saw Kyle Whittingham. I saw a bunch of my old players, and I actually told them that when I look back and I see what we did at a non-BCS school, and this is in the BCS era,
right,
and he took a bunch of players, and we followed Ron McBride, who was also an excellent coach, had good players there. I'd have to say that 2004 season was as enjoyable as I've ever had. We didn't win a national title. I still believe to this day that team on any given day could beat anybody. Our closest game was 21 points. And so I'm not sure it's fair to say, well, this was a better year. But as far as pure enjoyment with low expectation or minimal expectations to do what we did with those players, and Alex Smith as our quarterback going undefeated and go to the BCS game, that's as good a year as we've ever had.
All right, well, let's bring in your crew here from Fox College Football.
Supposed to clap.
Thanks for the clap.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Well, listen. It's a smattering of applause.
Is that how it goes, Johnny? Huh?
Appreciate it very much.
It's a live studio audience.
It is a live studio audience. Brady Quinn, Matt Leinart, Reggie Bush, and of course, you know, you have kind of the incomparable, the Fox Noon kickoff. Of course, you have your incomparable leader, Reggie. Let me just ask you, okay, yeah. Alex Smith was your high school teammate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you watched them play in college, did mm-hmm. you think they could beat anybody?
I thought they were special, yes. And I was also very surprised that he was using Alex Smith in the RPO system, because when Alex was in high school with us, he was the slowest person on our team.
Wing T.
Wait, you guys ran the wing T?
We ran the wing T. And Alex was the slowest person on our team. And so when I saw him at Utah outrunning people, I couldn't believe it was the same guy. But when Coach was there, I was 100% thought that they were really, really good.
You just didn't realize how fast you were and the rest of the team, right?
I mean, Brady, can you believe that he turned down Notre Dame because they didn't have good enough players?
I told him. I gave him a call. I try to recruit him. I found a way of getting his number. I think I called him once, maybe twice. I gave him my best pitch.
Did he say, who dis, new phone?
Terrible. No, apparently I'm not a good recruiter. That's why I didn't get into coaching. But no, he just said, look, this is a bigger decision for me and my family. And I kind of left it at that, but he appreciated the call.
Stoner, you've done a lot of things, obviously, for this company. Today, by the way, is Founders Day. I don't know how people nationally know that. It's the anniversary of the day that Fox Sports was launched. I think 26 years ago. I'm gonna go with 26 years ago. It sounds a lot better. You've done World Cup. You've done everything. But this is a massive show with massive egos. These guys.
No egos. There's no egos.
Huge.
No.
I mean, Leinart especially.
No.
Right?
USC, Notre Dame.
We're Orange County boys.
You got Notre Dame and USC, and 1.5 Heismans here, right? Yeah. I mean, that's what you got.
Coaching royalty.
You got coaching royalty.
Look, Urban knows this game better than me. Like, if you got talent, right, and you had talent in Gainesville.
Use your talent.
So I got talent. So I am. We're scripting some plays, and then just. Here's the ball. Go get them, boys.
Leinart, percentage of time that you guys are recruiting Urban to go back and coach at USC during the show?
Zero.
Okay, I just want to make sure.
This is our new team, man. This is right here, huh, Coach?
Okay, let me ask, because you and Reggie obviously are, and Coach can answer this. Mm-hmm. The challenges to Clemson, right? They lose 7 defensive starters, but they still have Trevor Lawrence. But especially for Trevor to come back a second time.
Yeah.
And have to prove himself. You know, last year he didn't start the year kind of with, they didn't sneak up on folks, but they did get to sneak up on folks. How much more difficult is it the second time around?
Yeah, when you have a year like he did, true freshman, win a national championship and the way he did it, you're a little bit worried about, all right, now the accolades, now everybody knows who you are, they're gunning for you. But something tells me this kid, he just gets it, he understands it. You know, he's so composed, he's so poised. I mean, I've never seen a freshman quarterback play like that, especially against Alabama in a national championship, and do it against Notre Dame the week before. So he's got a great head on his shoulders. Every interview he does, this kid just understands. And honestly, he's a rare talent. We haven't seen a kid like him in a long time.
It's crazy, Brady, because we sit here just talking about Trevor Lawrence when for probably 9/10 of the season, it was Tua, yeah. Tua, 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 Tua. And then all of a sudden, he's got a bad wheel, doesn't play that well, and it's like we've completely forgotten Tua. What are your expectations from the Bama quarterback?
I'm expecting them to be competing for a national championship. I think there's a lot of people who watch the national championship game. They watch the way it worked out, where Tua clearly didn't play his best game, but the team didn't either, and in particular, their offensive line. I think they're going to respond. I think they're going to rebound. I think the biggest issue for them is it's not talent. They've recruited well. They've got all that. It's the transition on the coaching staff. You know, Nick Saban lost a lot of assistants, but it's something he's dealt with before. And so I think because of that experience dealing with it, they should be fine. I expect them to be back in the college football playoff.
Coach, I want to ask you, Oklahoma has lost 2 consecutive number 1 overall picks, 2 consecutive Heisman Trophy winners. And they add Jalen Hurts, who, of course, has competed for a national championship. He won the SEC championship game last year. But he's entering a system where, you know, he's not the greatest thrower in the world. What's that like as a challenge for a coach in such short order? He hasn't had him in the system. He hasn't played in the style. He got him in the spring. He's got him in the summer. He's got him in the fall. And now all of a sudden he's supposed to be the next guy at Oklahoma.
Well, Ryan Day is dealing with the same thing with Justin Fields. This is more of a norm now than it was many years ago. I mean, this is a norm. You have Brandon Winbush. He's going to be starting for someone. I think the Lincoln Riley is such a good offensive coach. The staff consistency, the offense consistency, is very adaptable to different players. My issue at Oklahoma is to be on defense, is the obvious. I think offense will pick up right where they're going. He'll change a little bit because, obviously, Kyler Murray's a different player than Hurts. However, it's all about defense at Oklahoma. I mean, you can't advance and be 100th in pass defense. You can't. And so they have to get better, and they did. You know, you have to give him credit. He identified a weakness, made wholesale changes, brought in a new defense coordinator. And that's going to be Oklahoma's issue.
Reggie, West Coast football. Right, like you're a West Coast guy, Leinart's West Coast guy, I'm West Coast guy, Stoner's the king of Manhattan Beach. like this next weekend, not this one, next weekend is a Oregon, Auburn,
big, huge.
You got arguably the best quarterback or one of the best quarterbacks in the country against an Auburn team coming off a disappointing, they were only 3-5 in the SEC last year, and they got starting a true freshman, Bo Nix, at quarterback.
Yeah.
Does the Pac-12 come back into relevancy, in your opinion, this year?
I think they can with Oregon playing against Auburn, and I think Oregon can beat Auburn. Mario Cristobal is doing a great job at recruiting SEC-type players right in the SEC's backyard. They also have had their highest-rated recruiting class this year ever in the history of Oregon, which says a lot because they've had a lot of talent come through there. They also have experience, and they have great young players like Justin Herbert, who, you know, you got a guy like that you can build around, and they got an offensive line that can protect them.
All right, Brady, let's circle back around to Notre Dame. They have a stud quarterback, right? But how many years do we have to be told, no, really, Notre Dame is among the elite, and then we see him against the elite?
Come on, Doug. They were in the college football playoff last year. I know we want them to go and win.
We want them to be competitive. We want them to be competitive. Now, look, they will tell you, like, look, it was actually competitive at the half, but
Was the national championship game competitive?
No.
Okay. Go ask those Clemson players. They've said it on record who the better team was, who they played last year. They said it was Notre Dame between the two games. Now, I know the scoreboard was kind of similar. I think they're in a good spot, and I think they feel as good about this year's team as ever before because of the camaraderie and really getting to that point last year and playing against Clemson, who ended up winning it. Now they see what the standard is. And until you do it for the first time, you really don't know. And so I think Ian Book, the rest of the leaders on that team, they've got a good idea now of what they need to do moving forward in order to get there. I think the toughest thing they have to battle this year is their schedule. I mean, road games versus Michigan, Georgia, Stanford,
yep.
Seven teams coming off bye. That's the most in college football this year. I think those are the roadblocks they've got to get there because so many teams are going to have 2 weeks to prepare for them.
Stoner, how many times are you going to ask, is Texas back, right? We got LSU, Texas upcoming, right?
We have a preview show that airs tomorrow on Fox. That'll be topic number one when we talk about the Big 12.
We had to talk the Big 12. Okay, that's 4 o'clock Eastern time, 1 o'clock Pacific, big noon kickoff, preview show tomorrow. Let me ask you, Matt Leinart, is Texas back?
We'll see. I think when you look at Texas, you kind of got to just stop talking. You got to go out and do it. And last year, I think the way they ended – against Georgia in their bowl game, dominating that team who was supposed to be in the playoff. I think Texas has a shot. I still think Oklahoma is the best team in the Big 12, but I love, we joke, we talk about Sam Ellinger a lot. I love this kid. I think he reminds me a lot of Coach's former guy in Tim Tebow and the way he plays, the running style. I think he's probably a better thrower, you know, a natural thrower. But this team is close, and Tom Herman's done a great job. I'm excited to see what they can do.
All right, Coach, you have to be an analyst, okay? You have to cut away any of the Ohio State bias. Michigan is going to try and change who they are, right? They're going to try and open it up for Shea Patterson. And part of the problem with the quote in the book is it takes away from Shea Patterson, the talent that Michigan has, the schedule that seems to suit them as opposed to last year having to go to Notre Dame early in the year. How difficult is that? Now, he changed when he had Kaepernick, he changed in the NFL. But how difficult do you think that'll be for Jim Harbaugh to run an offense that is not really the offense that he traditionally you'd think would want to run?
Whenever you change systems, see, we change coordinators at Ohio State, really, because guys go on to be head coaches, but the system stayed the same. And I would always call it enhance a system. When you change a system, I'm anxious to see if they actually do. If they do, it takes time. However, they have three of the best. They have three high draft picks at receiver led by Peoples-Jones that people don't know about because they're underutilized. I mean, Donovan Peoples-Jones is a legit top 10 talent pick in the NFL draft. And I think, you know, you have a young coordinator, 35 years old, never won Gattis, never called a play. And he's, you know, Jim Harbaugh is a very strong personality. If they truly let this spread offense go, it's going to take a minute. The one thing they have, though, that personnel is ideal. Shea Patterson's a spread quarterback. Those receivers deserve to be able to play in space. Mm-hmm. I'm anxious to see if they really do it.
Reggie, Georgia came so close, right? So close. But Alabama has that thing that you guys had, right, where they just believe they're going to win, right? How hard is that to overcome? Because, like, look, personnel-wise, coaching-wise, helmet, logo, nickname, everything, Georgia has everything it takes to be the best team in the SEC, but Alabama has that kind of mental control over them. How hard is that to overcome?
I don't think it's that hard to overcome. I think it's just a matter of finishing games, right? Learning how to finish in the fourth quarter. We still have a saying at USC, you can't win games in the first, second, or third quarter. You got to win them in the fourth quarter, right? And it doesn't matter what the situation is. You always have to know and feel that you can come out on top, right? And it's a mentality. It's not about going out there working harder than the next person or everybody works hard. Everybody has talent. This is about finishing. This is a mindset. And so everything you do, whether it's in the team meetings, whether it's in reps in the weight room, is finishing through the line. I remember when we were training as a team, we would always make sure we finished through the line because we knew that if we implement this mentality now, it's going to serve us down the road.
Yeah, the Bush push, of course, helped beat Notre Dame.
That's one way to finish.
That's one way to finish.
That's one way to finish.
One way to finish.
By the way, Leinart's going to be signing autographs at the
W is a W,
the Centennial Modern Day game tonight. Leinart's giving away free autographs tonight. Just want to know.
Will you be there with me, man?
Sure. Rob Stone, Reggie Bush, Urban Meyer, Matt Leinart, Brady Quinn. That's 4 o'clock Eastern, 1 o'clock Pacific, big noon kickoff. Huge show every college football Saturday of the season. Men, thanks so much.
Be sure to catch live editions of The Herd weekdays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific.
I think there's some interesting things that happen in sports. Those where were you moments, right? And generally we think of where were you moments as, you know, challenger, explosion. I remember where I was in fourth grade, Mrs. Sally's class. We think of tragic events. Right? Sometimes we think of unbelievable comebacks and performances in sports. Like, I remember when the Patriots came back to beat the Atlanta Falcons that my kids wanted to stay up, and I said, go to sleep, this game's over. And then I promised my son, if it gets close, will you wake me up? Yes. And then it was like he was asleep for an hour and a half, and all of a sudden it was close. Couldn't wake him up. Right? So you remember those moments. But there are also moments that are the beginning of the end, right? The beginning of the end. And sometimes the moments are like when Marshawn Lynch didn't get the football, right? That felt like the beginning of the end of the Seahawks dynasty because you lost the team. You lost the defense. There was a mess last night in Winnipeg, Canada. Now, why are they playing a game in Winnipeg, Canada? I guess the answer would be it's fairly close. It's closer to Green Bay. And at the time when it was booked by a promoter, the Raiders didn't have a home and they didn't know where they were going to play. And so in kind of the ultimate money grab, which is what the preseason actually is, you know, like, I don't know how many people know this, but NFL players aren't compensated for preseason football. It's per diem, right? It's per diem. And then they pay for travel. And if you've looked at most of these games, you know, you actually get to pick a group of teams you want to play. So that's why the Chargers play, you know, a couple games at home, and then they play the Arizona Cardinals, for example, close in proximity as possible. The Jets play the Giants and the Dolphins play the Jaguars to cut down on travel costs. It's a money grab. But a funny thing happened on the way to the cash register. They forgot, or the promoter forgot, or whoever sets up the field forgot, that when you take out goalposts, like, there's a hole there. There's a hole there. Like, it's a goalpost is a thing. It's not like that old volleyball net in high school where, like, take out the volleyball net, and you put the little cap on it, and you don't even know it's there. Like, even though it's artificial surface, you take it out. There's a mechanism that you also have to remove with it, and you have to cover it up. It was not properly covered, and so you had these massive divots right in the middle of the front of each end zone, which led to the grounds crew coming out and doing the, I don't know, Derry. I don't know about the hole, Derry. I don't know how we can fill it in such short period of time. So they didn't. And they ended up playing a game on an 80-yard field. Now, it's not just the game was played on an 80-yard field, which looks like a bad scrimmage. It looks, and if you've ever been around, and Joel, you've worked NFL games. I got to work one last year. NFL games are the best run professional event I have ever been a part of.
There's a lot of moving parts to it.
There are a lot of moving parts. Remember, you have the TV, you have TV, you have both local radios, national radio, media, you have, and there's very limited number of people on the sideline, like sideline credential. I did Dolphins Bears last year. Peyton Manning escorted off the sideline before the game began. Like, he was like, I'm Peyton Manning. Like, yeah, I know. Gotta get off the sideline. Like, only authorized personnel only. There's a line that goes around each NFL field. Okay, do not step on, and definitely do not step inside that line. Why? Because that's the line. If you see it on this video, there's that yellow dotted line. That's the line for the TV cameras. They do not want anyone outside of the football players or the officials or the coaches inside that line. Period, stop, end of story. I was doing the Dolphins Bears, and I was into the sideline. I'm watching, and I'm stepping on the yellow line, and I have an NFL security guy come up and says, hey, if you step on that line again, we are escorting you out of the stadium. And I was like, I'm sorry, sir, I'm doing the game for Fox. Like, no, no, we know. This is from New York. Like, this is really important. So for this to happen is embarrassing to the league because their product is, and these are two historic franchises, and it's in Canada who wants to get a football team. Like, all of these things are important. So you play an 80-yard field. The Raiders don't bring 24 guys. Packers don't play their starters. And I feel like this is the beginning of this is the moment. Like, as you pointed out earlier, Sean McVay, from the moment he got the job, said, if you show me you can play football, I don't need to see you play football to know why you can play football, right? That's kind of his running line.
Right.
But this is the tie at the Major League Baseball All-Star Game. This, you know, this is the fail Mary. Remember the fail Mary?
Yep.
Packers, Seahawks, you're like, well, hold on. We got to get rid of these replacement officials and figure out a way to get it done. Right? That was a seminal moment. The Jesse James catch. I know that Dez caught it. Okay. I know that Calvin Johnson caught it. But Jesse James's catch is ruled a touchdown. The Pittsburgh Steelers have home field advantage in the playoffs, and it's a completely different postseason. Think of how big the play was last year in the playoffs, the Roby Coleman play with the Saints and the Rams. Such a big play that for the first time ever, we've had a judgment call able to be reviewed. There was remember the Saints-Vikings game? This was Brett Favre's last game where he threw the ball across his body, right? And the hometown, yeah, you can't do that! That game was lost because the Saints got the ball in overtime, marched down, and kicked a field goal and won it. And after that, we changed the overtime rules. I still don't like the overtime rules because it's both teams get the ball. Unless you score a touchdown, it feels like they've gone halfway. But that was a seminal moment. Here's one. 2003, the lowest rated NBA finals ever. Spurs versus Nets. Okay, you have the Spurs that everybody deemed to be boring against the Nets, Jason Kidd, Richard Jefferson, Kenyon Martin, right? That NBA Finals. Lowest rated NBA Finals ever. What happened afterwards? The NBA said, hey, we got to change this hand-checking stuff. We got to open up the game. They changed the rules. The malice at the palace led to the dress code. The dress code? So I think last night, I don't think it goes away. I don't think the preseason football immediately goes away. We're not going to cut off these two games. Daniel Jeremiah from the NFL Network and Hunter Henry of the Chargers came up with a plan that I would promote, which is two regular preseason games for the young guys and then two of these joint practices in the stadium. And then you can also bring the fans down. You can do 7-on-7. You can do all the stuff they do in the joint practices. You just don't have to do a traditional game. And that way you can protect the quarterbacks. Nobody touches the quarterbacks. Something has to give, and between the Rams not playing their guys for a third straight year, the Colts not playing their guys, the Packers not playing their guys, the Raiders not even bringing their guys, they don't even get on the plane, felt like last night was the tipping point.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just like you said, you're running down the teams that aren't participating. Teams are just taking it into their own hands. Like, okay, we realize this is not really necessary. Sometimes you just do things out of conditioning or tradition, and then someone like Sean McVay or whoever says, this doesn't really make sense that we're still doing this, so I'm just going to not do it. Will we be punished for not doing it? No, so let's just not do it and see what happens. And it actually turns out to be successful. It's 100% injury rate in the NFL for careers, right? We know that. There's no benefit, and we have this conversation every year. It's like once training camp starts, the time from the moment training camp starts until week one, everyone's just crossing their fingers, no injuries. Now, training camp, you can't avoid those, right? Like, it's going to happen, and it feels like even though it's dramatic and it sucks, it's like that's kind of part of the game. Like, it's an unfortunate place, but
no question,
that's a necessary evil. Preseason games are just not for guys who are trying to make the team. Yes, for rookies, yes. For the fringe guys are figuring out who you're going to keep on the practice squad and all that stuff. Yes, starters and close to starters, it just doesn't. What are you gaining there?
Well, just live reps, I think, is the thing. Like, real live reps.
Did you forget
reps.
How to play football?
You don't play that much. you don't play that much. And
I mean, I think what Sean McVay is doing is just is flying in the face of all of those things.
There's no question it's been successful, okay? But I guess the question becomes this, right? The question becomes, is there a control group? Like, look, has Sean McVay been successful? Yeah, he's been successful for 2 years. Part of it is he's a really good coach and he's a really good offense. And Jeff Fisher wasn't a very good offensive coach. And they've added a lot of pieces. Like, had they played their guys in the preseason, would they have not had two really good years? The answer is they probably would have been just the same. We don't know because there's no control group.
Right.
Right? And not every team that's not playing their players in the preseason is going to have a good regular season. So maybe that's what we see. But I do think that one of the things you hit on, which is a brilliant point, is this idea that we cannot, if you say you're doing something simply because that's how you've always done it, that's not really a great answer. Now, if you're saying you're doing it because you still think guys need live reps, that we don't practice as much, we don't have two-a-days, there's not as much contact, and it is a violent physical sport that you are going to, you have to learn how to play through contact. You have to learn to play, like as a quarterback. I mean, look at Jimmy Garoppolo. I'd have to think a good portion of the reason he struggled in his first preseason appearance was because he hadn't seen live reps, because he didn't have anybody at his feet, or in that case, the Broncos batting down passes. Right? You can't really replicate that even in scrimmages because quarterbacks aren't touched. So there is a value there, but is the value worth the risk? Is the value worth putting together a product that looks like a clown show like we saw in Winnipeg?
Right, and I don't think that – I'm not advocating for completely eliminating the preseason because I do think rookies need it, and I think that, for example, Jimmy Garoppolo coming off a devastating injury, that's useful. Fringe guys, you need it for those purposes, but do you need this much? Do you need four preseason games?
No, but that's, again, part of the how the money works because you get two home games, so you charge your fans. And look, there is a – where are you going to replace that revenue? And we always think of the revenue only for the owners. The owners, obviously, they don't want to make less money. But it's also the revenue for the stadiums. It's also revenue for all the surrounding bars, for parking, for the people who work in these stadiums. Like, there is a windfall of cash that's made, even if the places are half
full. Sure, and everything in our entire world, if you really get down to it, comes down to money. If we're having real conversations, that's really boring to just discuss the numbers because that's not fun.
Right.
But of course it comes down to the money. But I think you can find alternatives, like you said, make it a fan fest or make it something that's more interactive, like elevate the training camp experience to the stadium or whatever you need to do to find a way to balance the lack of competitiveness that you have for four games and get the guys that do need reps out there.